Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 401. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com, stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is This Show Is So Gay. And of course, go on over to that Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have a jam-packed show for you this week. Let's get started by introducing our first guest. Billy Beane is the only openly gay Major League Baseball player, current or former, alive today. From 1987 to 1995, he played for the Detroit Tigers, the Los Angeles Dodgers, and the San Diego Padres. When Billy came out in 1999, his story found nationwide media coverage, including on the Sunday cover of the New York Times, as well as so many networks like CNN. On December 8, 1999, he was interviewed by Diane Sawyer on the nationally televised TV program 2020. His memoir, I'm holding it right in my hands right now, Going the Other Way, originally published in 2003, became a national bestseller. Billy has become one of the leading role models for all athletes of diversity and one of the most sought-after motivational speakers in the United States. He currently serves as a Major League Baseball vice president and special assistant to the commissioner. On June 9th, Billy will be part of a special evening at Dodger Stadium, where the Los Angeles Dodgers will be playing host to their fifth annual LGBT night, which we're going to talk all about. But first, he is here with us, Billy Beane. Welcome to The Show Is So Gay.
Thank you, Ken. That's quite a little introduction. I'm going to have a lot to live up to in the next 25 minutes.
I'm feeling pretty confident. I am feeling pretty confident that you have been in bigger pressure situations than this one.
That is true. That is true. I'm actually very happy to be here, and anytime we can promote the inclusive message around MLB, I'm thrilled to participate. The Dodgers are a bright and shining example of what I think is just great for all of sports to see, not only MLB, but just the way that they have over the last 5 years made, you know, such an incredible effort to reach out to their LGBT community and bridge a relationship with the rest of their fans in the LA community. It's great.
Such great stuff. Well, let's talk about you a little bit, sir. You know, normally at this point in the show, I ask the guest, was there a defining moment for you when you knew your career would be your career? But I would imagine for you, it was just such sustained work to keep a major league career alive.
Well, I think there's some athletes that are just, you just know they're different. They're blessed in so many ways. I don't think I ever really knew I was going to be a big league baseball player until I was on a big league field. Like, it just did not seem, I was the oldest of five boys in a family, so all the sports experiences, I was first at them. So it was sort of paving the road for the rest of my family. But, you know, and once you're there, I got there quickly right out of college and had a lot of success on the way, which, you know, I'm very, very grateful for. But, you know, for me, sustaining that career, unfortunately, and maybe a lot of your listeners can relate to that, is I had never really addressed my sexual orientation. I never had met anybody as a youngster that was gay. My parents did not have a diverse group of friends, at least as far as, you know, LGBT community are concerned. And I got married very young, and I was, you know, great at sports and lived around sports and played, you know, basketball and football growing up as well. So it seemed like I had a game every day from the time I was 7 years old. And so, and I didn't grow up in the age of the internet. And I come from a very conservative family. And it took me until I was in my mid-20s to have the courage to explore, you know, the things that I think I was thinking about, but I didn't quite understand. And I certainly didn't feel like I could ever talk to with my teammates. And unfortunately, right around the time that I was starting to realize, you know, my hope and dreams of being a major league player is when, you know, the internal struggle with my sexual orientation. So it was a challenge. And, you know, the hard part of that experience is that I was probably my own worst enemy and had the talent to be a much better player than I was. I did play six seasons in the major leagues, but there were some tough times. And I feel like, you know, when I look at some other athletes and they were had a huge support group around them, and they were wired for success and believed that they belonged there. And because I was hiding something that seemed so impossible in the early 90s, and the only images I saw of our community were of men dying of AIDS,
right,
you know, on the news, and it didn't seem like the friendliest place to explore, and I didn't know where to start, so it was a tough road. It was definitely a tough road to go at that time.
Yeah. Now, you understand, I'm feeling pretty confident that you and I run in vastly different circles. You understand how it sounds to the rest of us to play six seasons in Major League Baseball, right? Like, that's pretty darn impressive, Billy.
Well, I appreciate it. I think I've started to, especially since my return to baseball 3.5 years ago, I've started to appreciate that accomplishment more. I was really hard on myself in the long time I was away from baseball, and I started to try to push it away, I think, because I had no closure with I left baseball right when I was at the peak of my physical ability, and emotionally I was more damaged, and I don't, you know, not to be a damper on the story, but the upside is the experiences like the one we're talking about on June 9th,
yeah,
where I can come back to baseball and see how the sport is becoming so progressive, where, you know, a generation before, it just was not talked about.
Right.
And it wasn't that baseball chose not to do that. It just was a different generation. And I think that now we all understand how powerful a positive message can be and the impact we can have on young people from every part of the diversity spectrum, because we start to see how much we have in common as opposed to, you know, whatever parts that we're confused by or don't understand or feel different from the person to our right or to our left.
Yeah. How do you go about wrapping your mind around just the national attention that your coming out generated?
That was tough because it was not a planned coming out. You know, a lot of people that came after me, I maybe saw the amount of coverage that I got and probably thought that maybe that was the better path for them. Mine was truly accidental. It was a culmination of, you know, being away from baseball, having really struggled with, you know, my family and our communication, and I lost my college roommate and a former Major League Baseball player, Tim Leona was his name, was killed in a car accident. And I had isolated myself from basically everyone, moved across the country, and I did not hear about his accident until after his funeral, a day or two after. And it really was like the last straw for me of hiding. And so long story short, I was opening up a restaurant in Miami, and the person that was writing the story said it would be very compelling to share the truth about you. And I just was fed up. And so it was just a little story about a restaurant. And then the next thing you know, I'm on the cover of the New York Times in a Sunday edition prior to the internet, which was a pretty large vehicle at that time. And then, like you said, Diane Sawyers and ESPN and all the people started coming after me to talk about what it was like. And I was not prepared for that. I did not, you know, when you think about hiding something for 30 years and then all of a sudden everyone wanting to talk to you about it,
right,
because there were no role models that had been in that position yet. And it was really the timing is what made it so unique. It wasn't that I was unique to LGBT community, but the fact that I was a part of the community and just happened to play Major League Baseball, you know, the collision of those two lives, it really put me out in front of people. And I was, at the onset, I was very, very intimidated by the things that I felt I did not know about our community. I had not really submerged myself in understanding the amazingly brave pioneers who came before me fighting for medications for our communities, trying to save lives of, you know, innocent people that were being ignored by our government and things like that. And it was, I think I felt like I was going to get exposed for being a bad person because I had shut off myself to my own family. I think one of the hardest things that I ever had to live with was not going to the funeral of my partner because I had a game, and I didn't think that I could tell the Padres why I was going to ask to miss the game. And I just sat there at the stadium that day, and I just wanted to die inside. It was a terrible, terrible time. And I think that because of the attention that I got while I had been out of baseball for a few years by then, I started to say yes to the community when I realized that they could be my mentor and help me grow into who I am now. And over, you know, the next 15 years almost, I tried to say yes as much as I could, and I learned a lot. I was around some things that were, you know, wonderfully empowering and some things that were heartbreaking for kids that had been bullied. And it just started to change my life, you know, meeting someone like Judy Shepard after Matthew Shepard's murder. And I started to see that it really wasn't about me. It was about a community, and that I had, for maybe for just a moment, an opportunity to do something productive with my life. And I stopped being afraid. I stopped living in shame. And I started to want to empower people that were younger than me or were going through a tough time, and to be a strong role model and not one that was a victim. Yeah. And that has really served me well. And I, you know, baseball took notice of that, I guess. And by circumstance, the timing was right for them. And now we're in a position to really impact lives. And a night like June 9th with the Dodgers is just a chance to celebrate the many good works that they do. I was in spring training with the Dodger Club, standing next to Dave Roberts, their manager, and talking to their big league team about respect and inclusion, the things going on in the world that are disparaging towards the LGBT community with many, you know, state-level religious initiatives. And, you know, sometimes I just have to take a deep breath and take it all in and realize, look how far we've all come. And, you know, I have to step up and I have to make the most of these opportunities that we can to educate our young players, because they can be such great ambassadors by just putting out, you know, a positive message. If that game comes and goes and I get, you know, six or seven of the players on the Dodgers to say, hey, how great it was, you know, this Friday night to see the whole LGBT community of LA or part of them come out and root us on, that would have such a positive impact for people that are watching maybe from a distance.
Oh, it's going to do that without question. As you look across the league, how do you divide your attention, right? So this is an amazing thing, right? June 9th, and everybody should be going, and it's the fifth annual LGBT night right there at Dodger Stadium. But when I read something like that, Billy, and I look, you know, I live about a mile from Progressive Field, and I'm thinking, okay, where's the LGBT night of the Cleveland Indians? How do we get traction on changing the rest of the league?
Well, it's important for people to realize that Pride Night is definitely a wonderful example of being progressive, but the Cleveland Indians, for example, have been one of the teams that I have visited the most when it comes to educating their players, nice. Talking to their front office. And in my opinion, nights like that will come when the time is right.
Yeah.
They're still subjective to each and every club. It's definitely not a requirement. I would take the opportunity to, you know, help, you know, develop well-rounded citizens coming through their organization first over a celebration at the stadium. If it meant I had to pick one of the two, I think they're all great.
Yeah.
But it is an interesting question. But and normally, Ken, I'll tell you that historically, the nights that manifest themselves like June 9th were started by the LGBT community knocking on the door of the ball club and saying, hey, we want to show you that we love our team just as much as anybody else, and we're going to bring a group, we're going to organize it, we're going to start as a group event and get 500-600 people to come. We want to sit together and we want to, you know, root on the Indians. And the Dodgers have a community in Los Angeles that did take that initiative. That has happened in Chicago. That's happened in Philadelphia. It's happened in many clubs around the league. So, and I will tell you that almost every group event, regardless if it's LGBT or Hispanic awareness or a military group or a chamber of commerce or any kind of a college night, it's that community has to take the initiative.
Yeah.
And they have to, you know, start the conversation somewhere, because the club's responsibility is to put a beautiful product onto the field and attract a place where their community can come and enjoy themselves and have some entertainment. And the Indians were one inning away from winning a world championship last year. They have a great young team. There's no reason why we couldn't get something like that done. We can't just sit on our hands and wait for everyone else to do the work. So I try to make myself available to each and every organization in whatever phase that they're at in that process. And it does take a little bit longer than others for some cities, but I try to focus always on the positive examples and not sit there and wait and talk about things that we haven't done yet.
Absolutely. Now, when I go over to Progressive Field and knock on the door, can I tell them that Billy Beane sent me?
You can tell them I sent you, and you can tell them that I will come and sit right next to you for the meeting.
If
that's what it takes. You know, I don't want to take attention. You know, the Dodgers have been great. They've asked me to be front and center many times. But these nights are not about Billy Beane anymore. You know, this is about the bigger picture, the millions of kids that have a smartphone and are watching, you know, streaming the games and watching and seeing what kind of messaging are we putting out? Are we talking about inclusion, racial equality, empowering people of color, you know, trying to be the communicator for a new whole level of dialogue about transgender community, things that empower, you know, our community and not isolate us or keep things quiet. And I think that there's a lot to digest and there's a lot going on. And the thing that I try to do with baseball is while I have this opportunity to have a little bit of influence is to make sure that we're creating community and not separating people.
Nice. Now, how much attention do you pay to other sports, right? I remember years ago, I wrote a piece for the Huffington Post, just kind of whining a little bit that there were no out gay male tennis players. And still, I am kind of in awe that there are no out gay male tennis players. How much of your attention goes to other sports? And because I feel like you probably have enough to do just looking at baseball.
Yeah, first of all, I'm a wonderful fan of tennis. I played, like I said, football and basketball. I'm a huge sports fan. We have a very big sport. The sport of baseball, you know, don't forget there's 240 minor league teams.
Oh, my gosh.
I go to the Dominican every year. We have every single club has a Dominican Academy for Hispanic players that pulls players from Venezuela, Mexico, Puerto Rico, other countries as well. We've had some Nicaraguan players, for example. We have players from Asia. I would be diverting my attention in the wrong ways if I was concerned with the same priority for other sports. I find it's an interesting dynamic for people on the outside looking at why athletes have chosen not to come forward, if indeed they are, like I am as part of the community. But it's a commentary about how not so much the culture as just the pressure that athletes are under.
Yeah.
And a respectful understanding of that, I think, goes a long way when you're trying to empower the athletes and understand, like for me, the amount of players that are out does not mean that we get an A or B or C or D or F on our report card for inclusion. It's what kind of culture are we having? Are we seeing less and less, you know, conflict with players, less, you know, feminization of men in the, you know, quotes in the media or on the field? You know, are we more empowering for women? You know, all kinds of ways where we're changing the dialogue, and in turn, all of those things will take care of themselves. I'm certain about players, you know, and athletes making personal decisions to bring their private life forward.
What I hear you saying is that Billy Beane has enough to do just focusing on baseball.
I have a lot of frequent flyer miles.
I bet. I bet. Well, on June 9th, as we have said, the 5th annual LGBT night, give us the pitch, Billy. Why should everybody come out and support this? Aside from the fact that they're going to get a great night of baseball.
Well, the Dodgers are an awesome team. That's one thing. The Dodger Stadium now, the way it is such a party, the collision of the cultures, that almost everyone's wearing a jersey. It's just a beautiful, fun environment. And they have a great manager. They got a great young group of players. Friday night in LA, the weather's going to be perfect, and then you're going to have music, and you're going to see the integration. Eric Braverman and then his boss, Lon Rosen, are geniuses when it comes to finding ways to like push the envelope, but keep it festive and keep it about baseball and keep it fun. I've had the best time every single one I've been to. You know, I'm from LA. It's in my heart and soul. I played for the Dodgers. I'm going to be playing in the Legends game on the next day, so I make it which is, you know, a wonderful privilege. So I can't endorse it enough. I just I think if somebody gives it a chance for the first time, they're going to become a fan forever, and they're going to feel connected to something that historically I know a lot of people in our community did not, they felt excluded. And it doesn't matter if you can, you know, if you're a good baseball player or you're not, but there's so many things to love about the energy, the in-game experience. You know, when I played on the Dodgers, it used to just be this sedate old organ music because it was tradition, right? You know, and now you have 70s, you know, rock, 80s, you know, pop hits blaring, and it's just a big party, and they have, you know, they're not doing it to sell tickets because they already sell out almost every night. They're putting an olive branch out to our community,
yeah.
And I think that we need to take advantage of this wonderful moment and, you know, find out for yourself if you love baseball or not.
I love that. All right, let's finish with some advice. Give me some Billy Beane patented advice for our listeners out there, possibly our gay sportsmen out there who are thinking about their careers and they're thinking about their place in athletics and trying to reconcile being athletic with being gay, which uh-huh. shouldn't be hard because they can live at the same time. Well, give me some Billy Beane patented advice.
I think the only advice that I could give is based on the mistakes that I made in my personal life. And I didn't trust, you know, if you're a great athlete or you have passion, you want to go to the Olympics or you want to run, you know, track in high school or make it to the big leagues or be the quarterback of the, you know, the New England Patriots someday, there's no reason why you can't realize that dream. It does take a village in many ways. And a part of the process, if you are, you know, concerned that your sexual orientation is going to be problematic or wondering who to trust, I wish that I would have trusted, you know, for some people it's your parents, sometimes it might be your brother, sister, or maybe your best friend, but coming out doesn't have to mean the whole world right away.
Right.
It means, you know, having a place where you feel safe or maybe you can cultivate a relationship. I cut off all the people that mattered to me because I was afraid that they would reject me if they found out the truth about me. And then, you know, I invested every ounce of my energy towards my partner, and he died, unfortunately, of HIV-related causes in 1995 and early that year. And I was not prepared for that to happen.
Yeah.
I did not even think about the possibility of that. And then I was alone. And I was around people, but I was alone in a way. And I know that if I would have had, looking back, if I had just talked to my own family, I definitely would not have retired when I did. I would have been able to grieve around people that loved me. I would have been able to share. And I would have got the best out of myself. So a long-winded answer to your question is to get the best out of yourself, you have to trust, you know, somebody. I know it's not easy and every situation is completely different, but being involved in sports is a wonderful way to challenge yourself in the journey of life. So don't think that your sexual orientation should have any bearing on the outcome. There's so many outlets that are healthy and safe. And for me, it should start with the people that you know love you the most unconditionally, your family. And if it's not there, then a friend or someone that you know you can trust.
For a second there, I believed I could win Wimbledon. Let me tell you this, listeners, Billy Beane is a Major League Baseball vice president and special assistant to the commissioner. On June 9th, he will be part of a special evening at Dodger Stadium, June 9th, where the Los Angeles Dodgers will be playing host to their fifth annual LGBT night. Everybody should go. Everybody should also check out, I have to tell you, Billy, one of my favorite pieces of writing out there is a piece you wrote called Brad Pitt Does Not Play Gay Billy Beane in Moneyball. He plays straight Billy Beane. And it's more than just about Brad Pitt and, you know, the other Billy Beane, but it's also about your place in sport. And you've inspired me for so long, and I know you've inspired so many people out there. And I just want to thank you on behalf of everyone for using your voice in the way that you do. It really does make a difference.
I really appreciate that, Ken. I it means a lot to me, and I appreciate the work you're doing and the positive messages you're putting out there. And it sounds like you're a tennis player, so we're going to have to try to hook that up someday, because I'm a big tennis player on the side, too.
Bring it.
Okay. All right.
All right, folks, and we are back with another amazing guest for this week's episode. Let me introduce her to you. Sue Kerr is a blogger and the founder and editor-in-chief of Pittsburgh Lesbian Correspondence. She has been blogging since 2005, and she was a co-founder of the Pittsburgh Women's Blogging Society. She is the organizer behind the hashtag Amplify Community Art Project, which is collecting such important stories. We're going to talk all about that. She has been published on the Huffington Post, the Blerico Project, Blogger, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, Pittsburgh's Out, Q Pittsburgh, and the Pennsylvania Progressive. Among her many honors, I like this one. Sue was named one of the 16 Pittsburgh social media mavens to follow. I don't even live in Pittsburgh, and I want to be one of the social media mavens to follow there. She was named that by the website Pop City, and now she is here with us. Sue, welcome to this show with So Gay.
I'm glad to be here and all my mavenness.
Yes, it's a lot. That's a lot to live up to be a maven. I barely even know what that means, but I would put it on my resume.
I totally did. It was on LinkedIn before the ink was dry on the website.
I love it. I love it. Sue, tell our listening audience, what does it mean to you to be a blogger?
Well, I will say it's changed a lot over the years.
Yeah.
So I'm in my 12th year now, but what it means now is to be a voice for the community and a forum to simple boost points of view that don't necessarily have a chance to get a place at the table or aren't reflected in the mainstream media. Being a blogger for me is an art. It's, you know, I never liked to think of myself as a writer. I was never the kid who kept a journal and thought I'd grow up to be a writer. But I, you know, have come to accept that I have written a lot.
Quite a bit.
Over 12 years. And for me, blogging is an extension of my work as a social worker and a community organizer. That was my professional life. And it was just a tool to try to, you know, work on the issues that mattered to me and the projects that were important to me. And it was a hobby. And now it's actually become more of a full-time gig for me.
A mutual friend of ours in a Facebook post just casually mentioned the word journalist, and you were really quick to chime in and say, that's not how I see myself. I see myself as a blogger. Talk to our listeners about that distinction and why that's important to you.
It's important because journalism and media, especially now in this current administration, is a profession, and there are standards, there are expectations, there's a training that people go through, and it's important that we distinguish professional journalists from people who just want to spout their opinions about things. I would put myself in the category of someone who wants to spout my opinions about things because I'm not trained. I took a Journalism 101 class in college 25 years ago, and but I don't remember, you know, certain things I learned.
Right.
And it's really important that there is a difference. Now, I think blogging is important. Blogging can be professional. Bloggers can be professional and all those kinds of things, but they're just not, it's not necessarily the case because literally anyone can start a blog.
Yeah.
I also want to be careful because here, I'm based in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and in all of Western Pennsylvania, there is no LGBTQ media.
Yeah.
There are no newspapers, not even any glossy magazines. There's just a few bloggers, there's a couple of newsletters, and that's it. So people do look to me for news and information, and so it's important for me to be mindful of that, that I don't want people to mistake what I'm doing as the same thing as a reporter at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette or on KDKA or any of those outlets.
Yeah. Do you think there's a certain style that we can all recognize, or in your mind, what distinguishes a Sue Kerr blog piece from others?
Well, for me, it's just, I try really hard to have an intersectional approach
nice.
To blogging. So all along, it was informed by the fact that I'm a woman, that I'm queer, I identify as a lesbian, but I identify as queer as well. Now I'm disabled. I became disabled in 2010. That I bring this perspective to what I'm writing, and it's not necessarily, I'm not going to sidestep the things that are difficult when there's a conflict between those identities, for example.
Yeah.
And, you know, I also really strive to live the ethos that, you know, the personal is political and the political is personal. And so when I'm writing a blog post about something that's hyper-local, I'm trying to put it in the context of what's going on nationally that I'm aware of. And vice versa, talking about, for example, when I write about the president and his administration, I am tying it back to what I see happening right here. We have a council race in our city council. And I see some similarities between Trump's campaign and the local Democrats, and I'm going to say that because, well, I guess that's what bloggers do.
So talk to me about the audience piece, because that's the tricky piece, right? Like we're in an age where I don't even think 5-6 years ago we were using the phrase clickbait, and how do we get people to like it and to share it? How do you strike a balance between putting your informed opinion out there and whatever role the audience plays in all of that?
Well, I've always tried, this sounds a little bit fanciful, but to be true to what I want to write about.
Yeah.
And to not pander, because it, I think that people immediately pick up on that. When you're writing a clickbait post, they know. I know when I read other blogs, I see, I can tell. And I realize that it's useless because it doesn't translate into people clicking through to read the real content on your blog.
Right.
So I'm not, I don't, that's not what I'm there for. I'm not trying to sell views on my, get to my ads or anything like that. So the audience is important to me in the sense that I want their feedback. I want to hear what they have to say. I like when people come to me with ideas or suggestions, send me a press release, whatever they want to do. I see that most of that happens off of the blog now. It happens on Facebook. That's my biggest source of referrals and engagement. But to some extent on Twitter and Tumblr as well, and even on Instagram. Writing a piece that resonates with people, I can really tell more from that engagement than I can from looking at my analytics and seeing how many people click the website. Sadly, you know, the pieces that draw the most attention are the toughest pieces, you know, the pieces about crime,
yeah,
violence, murder. Those pieces are, I don't want to use the term popular because that sounds terrible, but they're very well read. And I think it's because there's not a lot of people writing about those topics. So.
Right.
So what I often get is people who say, accuse me of using those incidents to draw people to my blog, and which is so macabre.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I just think, you know, I don't enjoy delving into this story for, you know, 2 or 3 hours to put it together. I mean, it's not like a top 10 list. And it's also, it's very insulting to the person who, you know, is the victim of the crime and suggests that. But I don't know. I guess I'm just not a clickbait person.
I appreciate that. That makes me happy. That's a good thing. That's a good thing. For our listeners who don't know about the Pittsburgh Lesbian Correspondents, tell everybody about that group.
Well, it's just really me and my partner, Laura, to some extent.
Yes.
When I thought I'd give this blogging thing a shot, I was doing a gig with local radio host, and he was calling me his Pittsburgh Lesbian Correspondent. So it seemed like a good name for a blog.
I love it.
And yeah, it was just kind of a, you know, again, I wasn't thinking, where would I be in 12 years?
Right.
And so we don't, you know, it's a project of my business to cat social. I do social media work for people, and it's really like off of my couch with a laptop set up on a TV tray. And I do have contributing bloggers. My partner does write once in a great while when she can remember her password. And I have at least one other active contributing blogger right now. And I'm always open to people. But we don't make money. I mean, we have some advertising and so forth. But so I can't pay people to blog. And I don't feel that it's right to ask them to write for free. So
right.
if someone approaches me and wants to do it, that's great. I'd love to have more voices. I also know that the name kind of doesn't, I don't know if it doesn't fit anymore, but, you know, I'm still identified as a lesbian, but I definitely think it's more of an LGBTQ blog. But, you know, it's kind of hard to change 12 years of...
Right, of branding. Yeah, no, that's rough. That's rough. You know, right there, if people go to, and they should, it's pghlesbian.com, Pittsburgh Lesbian Correspondence. They can learn all about the hashtag Amplify whole project. Tell our listeners about that. I love it. I've gone through so many of these and been so inspired by the people that you feature on there.
No, I'm glad. Well, so we have over 200. I think we just published number 206. This is an archive of LGBTQ stories, and we are telling them in a Q&A format. And so the person who wants to participate will go to an online form and fill out the Q&A, and then I publish it without editing their responses. And the project grew out of our artist residency that I was invited to participate in with a local gallery here in Pittsburgh, and they wanted me to come up with a community art project. And I thought it was a really good way to create this kind of like living record of what life is like in this region for the end of the 20th and the beginning of the 21st century, and also do it in people's own words rather than me, in my words or my filter. I also really like the blog piece because I can allow people to be anonymous. I know who they are, but... you probably have came across that in the archives, that there are people who either use a fake name or a nickname, or they don't share, so they don't submit a photo. So we really can include a lot of people. This has really been true for people who are closeted. It's been very true for people who live in rural areas where they're not safe. They don't feel safe, I should say, coming out and, you know, tying their name to this, but they can still, they still have something to say.
Yeah.
And, you know, the fact that they're anonymous in a blog format, it's not, it doesn't take away from the power of their story. In fact, maybe it adds to it a little bit. The project is, we started in 2015, and we are at this point going through 2018, and we'll see where we go from there. Our focus area is Western Pennsylvania. We have 26 counties identified, and all we want are people who are LGBTQ identified and have ties to this region. And it doesn't even have to be that you live there, grew up there, went to college. It could, you know, we had a man who, his whole recovery was in Pennsylvania. That's where his AA group was, and so it was very, you know, it was a very important part of who he was. Is that, you know, he had to leave his where he lived and went to Pennsylvania, and to me that's a pretty profound experience that we want to include in what we're doing. So it's really. I guess I struggle sometimes to find the words because I'm just so humbled when I read the stories. People get really deep.
Yeah. People have to check that out, folks. It's the Amplify Project, hashtag Amplify, and it's located right there at pghlesbian.com. You know, obviously, it's also right there in the title on the homepage and on every page. Pittsburgh features heavily in what it is that you do. On behalf of the Pittsburgh Tourism Bureau, sell our listeners on the great things happening in LGBTQ Pittsburgh.
Well, Pittsburgh is just rife with all kinds of interesting stuff. One thing I noticed is we had our third LGBTQ parenting group has formed, which is wonderful.
Nice.
Now there are three different groups that are doing all kinds of activities that are family friendly and kid oriented, and all kinds of families can participate, which is great. We have a thriving community that's led by members, individuals who are transgender. We have a real emerging group of queer trans people of color leaders who are taking on roles and, you know, challenging the rest of us to really think about how we allocate resources and who's at the table and who's leading us. And yeah, that's really great.
You guys do a lot. It's great. I visited recently for the first time not that long ago, and I didn't know much about Pittsburgh. I have a vague sense that there's some sort of Pittsburgh-Cleveland rivalry, which I don't know. Again, I'm pretty new to all of this. I had the best time in Pittsburgh. I was also told that the downtown has changed quite considerably in the past few years.
Yeah, it has. I live right by the Heinz Field where the Steelers play. I'm about half a mile from there, so I'm very close to downtown as well. And I grew up here. My family's been in this region for 250, 300 years.
Nice.
On almost all sides, so I do genealogy on my blog, too. So you'll come across those stories once in a while. And so I feel very Pittsburgh. But what's interesting about this region is that Pittsburgh is sort of this little hub of progressive activity in a very conservative region of the state. Like southwestern Pennsylvania has the lowest approval ratings for LGBTQ equality initiatives. And so what Pittsburgh hasn't done is really trickle down to the other outlying counties. What's happening is that I think as people in those counties are getting empowered and access to resources, they're changing what's happening versus it coming from Pittsburgh, which is the way it should be.
Right.
The people who live there doing it. Pittsburgh has a lot of like wonderful neighborhoods. I think we have 97 neighborhoods in our city. I mean, it's a lot. And wonderful restaurants. The thing we don't have is a gayborhood. That's it. If you knew the geography of Pittsburgh, it would just never work. There are different pockets where people consider themselves to be welcomed or safe or have access to resources, but that varies from person to person. And I don't think that will ever change. You know, our community is built, you have to either go online or put some miles on to get to the spaces that we have. We have a Prasad Center, which is the second oldest LGBTQ-specific mental health counseling center in the country. And it's also a community center, and they have a lot of really great programming going on there. And so we have a lot of things to be very proud of in our community. And I wouldn't define it by one event. But since you mentioned the rivalry, you know, the Pirates have been a big supporter of the LGBT community going back to 2004, actually. They had the first Pride Night PNC Park. So they were kind of ahead of the curve.
Amazing. Amazing. And especially on this week's episode when we just spent, you didn't even know this, a whole half an hour talking about Major League Baseball and the support there. So more work to be done, but good things happening in Pittsburgh. I want to go back and visit. Again, listeners, we are here with Sue Kerr, blogger, the founder and editor-in-chief of the Pittsburgh Lesbian Correspondence. Let's talk about a couple specific pieces. You mentioned your passion for genealogy, and I know this piece just had some resurgence that you published back in September. You met your first openly gay relative.
Kind of.
Right. The timing was perhaps not ideal, but it was really exciting to read about that in your efforts.
Oh, well, I'm glad that you enjoyed it. Yes. Lowell was my grandmother's second cousin, and he died in April of last year, and I didn't ever, he lived in Arizona, and I learned about him as I was doing my research. I came across his obituary, and for he and his husband, they were listed as each other's spouses, and it was, so that's how I knew for sure that they were gay, because I have a lot of people that I run across who I'm not sure, they're not married, but there's no actual evidence of whether they are gay or not. And when I met Lowell, it was really powerful for me, because I have now 16,000 people in my family tree, and I really don't know very many LGBTQ people. Among my peers who I live in Pittsburgh, I've since met one or two. We haven't actually met a person, but we've connected, I would say, who are alive and are here and are my generation, but we haven't made that move to meet. And it was really powerful to realize that not only was he gay but then he was accepted by his family, and
right.
His mother lived with him. His nieces and nephews took care of him. You know, he and his husband lived in D.C. And I just think, oh my God, I wish I had had a chance to ask him, like, what was it like? I mean, he was alive during Stonewall, you know, and then just to wonder, like, you know, would those people who are also my cousins, his family, would they welcome me? Because I don't feel very welcomed by my own family. I feel tolerated.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of listeners can relate to that.
Absolutely.
That there's a distinction. And so it was really moving for me. And I wrote that piece, I think, in September and put it up on Huffington Post. And I was surprised to suddenly see a lot of hits coming into my own blog from it and realize that they had promoted it. And it's been up for a couple weeks on the Queer Voices page. So maybe I am a better writer than I think.
I can only assume that you are. I mean, you are a great writer, but I need you to think that you are better than you are, because this sentence just really shredded me in a beautiful way. You wrote, "It took more than 7,000 people and almost 20 years to find him, but now I know that I am not alone." Of course that's going to strike a chord, Sue. That's good stuff.
Yeah.
It's good stuff.
Yeah, thank you.
Now, you and I have also shared a similar experience in the past few months, and that was that we both had the opportunity to interview Emily Saliers from the Indigo Girls. How was that experience for you?
Well, actually, my partner did the interview, but I was here the whole time because it was a phone interview. I will tell you that it was really amazing to me when they said yes, because I pitched the promoters and said, "Hey, do you think that they'd be interviewed by us?" And when they said yes, I was shocked, because the Indigo Girls don't need a blog like me to, you know, they sold out anyway, but, you know, it wasn't something that they needed to do. I get a lot of requests from very small emerging artists who are looking for exposure, but
right,
they didn't need that. And instead, it was a real gift to me to take the time to talk with us about the issues that we, you know, we were concerned about. And so I will just, my loyalty to the Indigo Girls is quadrupled now. It was a really funny kind of afternoon, because my partner had to like rush home from work and go into the kitchen, and then our cats were all like in a kerfuffle. It was, and I felt like that BBC mom that was going in and grabbing her kids from the husband was on the air, and the kids came into the room, and you remember that little
anecdote?
That,
of course.
And I felt like that, because I'm trying to grab our big tabby and get her out of the room, and she's squawking hysterically. And, you know, you can't quiet a cat.
No.
So I couldn't really, I had to hold her the whole time in the other room. I was trying to listen to the, I was like, that's Emily. And I was very fangirling.
I did exactly this. Oh my gosh. I was an absolute mess.
And she's really nice. I mean, she was very cool about the cat thing, but she also she took the time to say, "Oh, I really like these questions. These are, you know," and really just give back. And I just thought, this is why you have such a loyal fan base, because it's a lot. It's about more than just, you know, selling records.
Yeah,
and she's great.
She's great, and these are always reminders for me. You know, these experiences of talking to Emily, of talking to you, of just people interacting. Of that's right, we do have this vibrant community, and if we can carve out that time and space to actually have an interaction, amazing things happen, and that energy is shared, and it's a beautiful thing. And I saw that in the interview that you guys did with Emily, and I love it. I absolutely love it. You know, normally at this point in the interview, I would be asking the guest, well, what's coming up for you? But that's a little bit different for you. How do you determine, okay, here's the consistency with which I will be blogging? Because you write a lot.
Well, Amplify adds to that. So, because I intentionally have those posts on my blog, because my blogging draws more visitors, and I want those people to read the Q&As.
Absolutely.
So they're co-mingled on the feed. But I try to blog 3 to 4 times a week, just to kind of keep myself emotionally invested and agile and all of those kinds of things. So sometimes I have to dig for topics. I am focusing on Amplify right now. We, you know, like I said, we've crossed 200, but there are a lot of people in this region.
Right.
So we're looking ahead. And one of our big challenges is going into the rural counties. So this is going to kind of sound weird, but like northeastern, western Pennsylvania, up north above Penn State, in those counties, Forest, Elk, that sort of area, we don't have any responses. And so we're going to have to go up there and spend some time on the ground doing some community building and networking with informal people. And we're also really hoping to secure some funding to be able to record the Q&As from community elders and people who can't use a computer for whatever reason. It's not going to be an oral history. It's going to be the same format where I'll read the question, they'll respond, and we'll have it typed up and put onto, you know, the website, just like somebody who used the form. And the difference is that hopefully we'll be able to capture people whose voices, you know, they may not be using Facebook right now. So, and then that's expensive. And, you know, I talked about that in another context about transcription services. And, you know, we have a queer transcriptionist who's willing to help work with us, but it's still going to be $125, yeah, $200 per piece. So we're hoping to find funding, and which takes a whole significant amount of energy to pursue. And but we've been very lucky. We were supported by the Pittsburgh Foundation for a year, and that allowed us to get off the ground. So it's election season here. We have a mayoral election in Pittsburgh, so I'm writing about that quite a bit. We have one city council race that's very important, more for LGBT people, but more from a, like, an anti-poverty, social justice angle. It seems like I'm never lacking for something to write about.
Right.
And, you know, Pride season's coming up. There's a lot of events, some of which I'll write about because I like them, some of which I'm not a big fan of, but I won't. and then, of course, Amplify, you know, pieces that we have coming up. I do write a lot of composite pieces, like trying to group everything so you can read all the contributions from the bi community, and I just did one of we had 59 lesbian identified contributors. So trying to kind of reframe it as often as possible and get it in front of people so they'll do like you did, which is fall down the rabbit hole and start clicking from one to the next. And
it's such a great thing. It's a great immersion to do. Listeners, this is what we need you to do. Stroll on over to pghlesbian.com. That's pghlesbian.com. And you can learn all about Sue. You can access the hashtag Amplify Project. You can read so many of Sue's words. I will tell you this, Sue. One of the reasons I wanted to have you on the show is that I think that sometimes we fall into the trap of, oh, we got to feature the loudest voice. We have to feature the loudest voice. And one of the things that you have done so beautifully for 12 years is showed the importance of a sustained voice. And you wrote in that Emily piece, you wrote, I've been blogging at the Pittsburgh Lesbian Correspondent since 2005. Never has the need for a queer women's perspective on all of the things seemed so necessary for survival than right now. And that's what you're out there doing, Sue. And I hope you know how inspiring it is to see that sustained voice.
It makes me a little sleepy for you to say that, but I appreciate that. It is important, you know, and I encourage everyone who's listening, look for local LGBTQ blogs. They're on Tumblr. They might be on Facebook. Just do some Google searches. Find those folks. Read what they're saying and let them know that you care about what they have to say because it matters.
It does. It does. Again, listeners, pghlesbian.com. Sue, please keep doing what you're doing.
Oh, the same to you. And thank you for having me on the podcast.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, not a ton of time left on this week's episode, so let's get to some of the latest LGBTQ news that's out there. One of the most powerful countries in the world has reportedly elected a man who says he opposes homosexuality. This man has been elected to be president of that country. Voters in South Korea, the 11th richest nation on earth, have seemingly handed a sizable victory to Moon Jae-in, a former human rights lawyer. Exit polls conducted jointly by three TV stations have indicated a win for Moon, the liberal candidate, over conservative nominee Hong Joon-pyo by 41.4% to 23.3%. Moon, who has consistently held a lead over his rivals throughout the campaign, was asked during a live television election debate 2 weeks ago whether he was against homosexuality. He responded, "I oppose." When he was asked to clarify whether he positioned himself against homosexuality, he replied, "Of course." He also agreed with his opponent that the presence of gay soldiers was weakening the military, and he emphasized his opposition to same-sex marriage during the debate. Same-sex marriage is illegal in South Korea. So there you go. The man elected to be president of South Korea, not a fan of his LGBTQ citizens, of which there are LGBTQ citizens there. In Miami, a man has been attacked in Miami while walking his dog. He was subjected to homophobic abuse and he was told, "It's your day to die." Police are investigating the attack on Ken Wilcox, which took place on South Beach in Miami. He said he was passing Flamingo Park on Meridian Avenue when two men began yelling the anti-gay slurs at him. He told these various news outlets they hit him. They said they were there to kill him. They started striking him. They grabbed his arms from behind while the others started hitting him. He said that he sustained a facial injury near his eye, saying this quote, "My deepest injury and laceration is here, and that goes all the way to my skull. I have 3 cracked ribs on this side, and then on this side, and I have 1 cracked rib on the front of this side." So a gay man seemingly attacked there in Miami. It's always a reminder for everyone to be vigilant. You must always, always be vigilant, no matter where you live. A spokesperson for America's most prominent Christian pressure group has claimed that defending people with anti-LGBT views is, quote, the only religious liberty issue that matters today. The only religious liberty issue that matters today. Brian Fisher, the host of American Family radio show Focal Point, made the shocking assertion in a blog for the American Family Association, which is, of course, a fundamentalist group which claims to protect Christian values. In his blog, he lambasted the removal of Donald Trump's nominee for Secretary of the Army, Mark Green, over his extreme anti-LGBT views. After his nomination was made, it became clear that this nominee for Secretary of the Army, Mark Green, he had made a string of disturbing statements. He had branded transgender people as a, quote, disease, and he called for evil to be crushed in a rant about LGBT rights. Green then withdrew his nomination, saying his views had become a distraction. Well, in his blog for the AFA, Mr. Fisher wrote this, quote, "The homosexual activists ran Green out of town because he believes that honest mental health professionals will tell you that transgenderism is a disease." Citing evidence from long-debunked studies, Fisher added this, quote, "He should be praised for both views rather than exiled from public service. What good is it to have religious freedom if the moment you exercise it, you are punished and driven to exile? If Donald Trump could not find a way to stand up for Mark Green, he is no true defender of religious liberty. If he will not defend his own pick for military leadership against the gay Gestapo, of what use will he be in the pitched battle over First Amendment civil rights for people of Christian faith?" There you go. So many pieces to that puzzle. First of all, there's apparently a gay Gestapo. Am I in that? That sounds like an extreme group. Second of all, and more importantly, and not at all snarkily, if it was just the LGBT community that was standing against Mark Green, I am telling you right this very second, folks, he still would be the nominee for Secretary of the Army. The fact is, we are at the point right now where you can't actually say things like that and be accepted by mainstream society. It doesn't work like that anymore because the majority of Americans simply do not believe that. So that is what happened to Mark Green. It wasn't the gay Gestapo. It was the fact that you cannot express these views under the guise of religious liberty and think that you can just get any post that you want. Doesn't work like that anymore. And finally, a number of lesbian couples are suing the state of Tennessee over a newly introduced law which says laws should be interpreted in a natural and ordinary way. The law was enacted by Governor Bill Haslam last week, and it is feared to have potential to challenge the U.S. Supreme Court ruling on same-sex marriage. Haslam, as well as the state itself and the State Department of Health and its commissioner, they were all named in the lawsuit filed this week in Davidson County Chancery Court. The four lesbian couples who are plaintiffs in the lawsuit are all expecting children conceived with artificial insemination. According to LGBT advocates in Tennessee, the law's natural and ordinary meaning clause could undermine same-sex couples in any statute, including the words husband, wife, mother, and father. That is going to be an important lawsuit there in the state of Tennessee. We will keep our eyes on that. For now, though, that's all the time we have for this week's episode. Our thanks, of course, to Billy Bean, the incredible work he is doing there in Major League Baseball. Our thanks to Sue Karen, the incredible work she is doing online. Check out all of the words that she's putting out there. They are important. And our thanks, of course, to you all for checking us out, for listening, for downloading, for subscribing to our podcast right there on iTunes. Get out there, folks. Go use your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference for all of our LGBTQ brothers and sisters out there, for all of those allies. Use your voice, make a difference, and please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?